enormity of task at hand cannot just be borne by a state. The federal government has a moral and ethical and economic obligation to help support the states. After all, what is the point of government if not to protect people, their safety, and the well-being of citizens?
California Governor Gavin Newsom yesterday imploring the federal government to send money to California and other states. Newsom said without federal help, California is facing a $54 billion shortfall. It is the most rapid financial collapse ever recorded in modern history here in California. And with the state going from a comfortable budget surplus to a massive deficit in just about 8 weeks. Joining me for analysis today is KCRW's Morning Edition host, Cherry Glazer. Hi, Cherry.
Hey there.
And also joining us from her home studio in the Bay Area is Marisa Lagos, political reporter for KQED. Hey there.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you back. And Howard Bloom is also here, education reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Hi.
Hello.
Well, 4 months ago, the governor proposed a budget from basically an alternate universe. He was looking at record state revenues. He was proposing all sorts of funding increases. And now he's saying there's a 75% drop in tax revenue, basically because businesses aren't in business and many people are unemployed. And he announced a $54.3 billion deficit and huge cuts. Marisa, what is he proposing to cut?
Well, I mean, look, education is always the biggest part of any state budget, along with health and human services. And so those are usually the places where we have to, where, you know, any governor has to look to cut. Schools, he's trying to sort of cushion those cuts. They could have been up to $19 billion under the sort of automatic formula that is in state law. Newsom says between the federal money from that CARES Act that passed a little bit ago and moving around some state money, deferring some state pensions. Payments to try to draw down those obligations and actually giving that money to the districts for their own obligations to the pension system, that shortfall will be closer to $10 billion, which is still, of course, devastating for schools. And then a lot of the sort of ambitious things that he had proposed in January, including expanding Medi-Cal, that's the state Medicaid program for low-income adults. They wanted to expand that to seniors who are undocumented, folks over the age of 65. That's been whacked out of this budget. So, you know, and then there's a litany of other sort of smaller things that all add up to what, you know, they're looking at, which is $19 billion in cuts for the fiscal year starting July 1st.
Wow. It's just extraordinary. It's hard to really wrap your mind around that. It's such an enormous number. Howard, let's pick up on what Marisa was saying in terms of the schools. Your story in the paper today, the headline says California schools face devastating coronavirus cuts. What does it mean, these billions of dollars of cuts that the schools will likely have to take on? What does that mean trickle down to the classroom if kids actually return to classrooms?
Well, of course, those decisions are going to be made district by district because the state never mandates to school districts how they should cut money. They only tell them how much they tell them how much money they're going to get and from the state, and it's going to be less. So the one interesting thing about this is that there is even the possibility of something like teacher layoffs and other staff layoffs. Because normally, if you're going to lay off a teacher, you have to give them notice by March 15th. But in an emergency budget situation, that window for layoffs reopens from the beginning of July to about mid-August. And for the non-teaching staff, you just have to give them 60 days notice. And that would be an irony in this time when we're trying to think of how we can make class sizes smaller to battle the virus, when we might actually have more students per teacher. Now, that's the other thing that districts are saying. They're saying, well, here you are cutting our budget in a time when, in fact, we have increased costs because we have to figure out a way to make campuses safe and maybe stagger schedules and buy hundreds of thousands of masks and increase our cleaning staff. And do we clean between classes? What does it mean to sanitize a classroom? Mm-hmm. So there's definitely a lot of anxiety in school districts up and down the state at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, here's what the governor said in terms of possibly getting some help with that funding from the feds.
We're going to use some $4.4 billion from the CARES Act to allow for real discretion in real time and put that money, rather than in the general fund, we're going to put it into public education, $4.4 billion, to address the issue of learning loss.
So what does that mean exactly? What is he saying that money is going to be spent on? Howard.
Well, that's a good question, because if you're telling districts, instead of giving you a lot less money, we're going to give you a medium amount of less money, that districts are not overly thrilled by that. So yes, the governor could have spent this money on something else. So it could have been a lot worse. It could have been twice as bad, twice as much cutting for education. But when you're saying that you're going to address this money for learning loss, the money that he's saying can be used to address learning loss is still leaving them with a total that's less than what they would have had before. I mean, arguably anything a school district does addresses learning. So whether it's learning addition or learning loss, it's all about learning. So, he has a lot of flexibilities for this, how this funding should be spent. But to me, what he's really saying is, I could have sent this money somewhere else. I'm sending it to you instead. Do the best you can to make things better than they would have been otherwise. I mean, the other interesting thing about this budget is he had a lot of new programs for education that were going to roll out in January, and all those have now been pulled off the table, except he is doing a little more funding for students with disabilities.
Well, I mean, Howard, does he really have a choice? As Marisa said, there's not a lot of places where you can cut when you're running the state government, because so much of the funding is already baked in, and education is pretty much one of the only places, aside from Medi-Cal, that you can get big cuts from.
Right. No, he doesn't have much choice. That's why he's appealing to the federal government, and the federal government has come to the aid of school districts in the past. So the Obama administration provided a lot of aid to the states, which ended up going to a lot of that money went to education. Now, Jerry Brown, in the midst of a recession, said, I'm going to cut all this funding from education unless voters pass this tax increase. So that was the deal that he put on the table. And the voters delivered. They approved a tax increase. The Obama administration delivered. It remains to be seen if the Trump administration will deliver. Now, there is on the ballot in November a tax increase that would result in more money for schools and other public services if voters decide to pass that. I don't know if a tax increase is going to pass in this kind of climate.
Is this the Prop 13 revise? Is that what you're referring to, or something else?
It is indeed. It's what they call, that's the one. It's the split roll where they would remove businesses from the Prop 13 tax protections, which would theoretically raise a lot of money. And a lot of that money would go to schools, and this would be a good time for it. But there are people arguing on the other side that, after all this economic torment, you're now going to raise our taxes. So, that was not going to be an easy thing to pass previously. It remains to be seen if that can pass in this climate.
Right. But that's a ballot initiative. So that is something the voters would decide.
Right. It also means that even if the voters decided this, the money would not come immediately. So really, the hope here in the short term is that the Trump administration, the Senate, something like the bill that's in the House right now. I mean, basically, Gavin Newsom said in so many words, if the federal government approves the bill that Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leader of the House, has put on the table, if they just do that, then these cuts to schools will be much less severe.
Marisa, what is the likelihood of that? It seems from reporting in Washington that this is a non-starter on the part of the Republicans. They're not even going to consider this bill that Nancy Pelosi wants.
Yeah, and, I think like most things in our split Congress and in legislative bodies in general, I think Pelosi and Democrats see that as a starting point. I think that there is going to be political pressure on Mitch McConnell and the president to do something more, because it's not just blue states like California that are looking at decimated state and local budgets and the possibility of laying off firefighters and police officers and teachers, right? This is going to happen across the nation. This is a global pandemic. So I try not to make, predictions anymore. More about politics, because we seem to be wrong quite a bit these days. But, I do think that there is a possibility that something happens, maybe not all $3 trillion that Pelosi's put forward. Maybe there's tweaks in it. I know both the left and right flank, or left and center flank within the Democratic Party, each have their own ideas about that bill. It's also worth noting, you know, this is a fiscal year beginning in July, and Newsom has basically crafted this budget so that if federal aid comes through, even if the budget's already in effect, there are sort of automatic pullbacks of some of these cuts. And so I think it's a kind of interesting strategy. I would also note, you know, just as an aside, that it is fascinating to see how different some of the approaches already are to some of these things. I mean, you know, I think you guys hit on a really interesting point, which is this question of like laying off public employees at a time when we're already spending, you know, some 600 times or something insane on unemployment insurance, where there's a lot of questions about the cliff that was written into the previous federal act because the extra money for unemployment runs out on July 31st. So I think that even if something doesn't happen in the next month and we do pass what looks like a pretty painful budget in California, who knows what the next year holds? Who knows who gets elected in November and who holds the cards come January? So it just feels there's so much uncertainty right now, Madeline. And I think the governor's budget reflects that. But the truth is that the state can't print money and they have to pass something before the fiscal year begins this summer.
Wow. Well, speaking of, you alluded to this, the incredibly high unemployment rate. The governor projected a 25% unemployment rate, one in four people out of work. Is that permanent or temporary? What do you say about that?
I mean, I think that's the thing, is that this is such an unusual a recession in the fact, as you said at the top, that it happened like virtually overnight, that I think that there's a lot of open questions about what the recovery could look like. But all of those hinge on these public health things that, you know, we as citizens don't have a lot of power over. Is testing ramped up? Can we go back to a semblance of normal? I mean, if businesses are able to keep their doors open and don't have to actually shutter, I think that we could see a faster economic rebound if things kind of get under control with the pandemic. But at the, you know, at this point, nothing material has changed since we went into lockdown when it comes to widespread testing or vaccines or therapies. So It feels like I think there's a lot of people who are hopeful that we could bounce back quicker, but I think that's going to depend on a lot of actors, including the federal government, and not just around giving money to the states, but around supporting the states in, you know, both the research and development of therapies or vaccines, but also just strictly the testing and the antibody testing and all this contact tracing that you're hearing a lot about.
Right. And so I want to bring in Cheri Glazer here. Cheri, I did not forget about you.
Not to worry.
When it comes to this aspect of the story, it's a huge aspect. And that is, a lot of people are wondering, well, what has changed in the state to let us start to reopen businesses, cautiously reopen businesses? I can see in certain rural parts of the state that that don't have a lot of cases and a lot of deaths. But here in L.A., I think L.A. is responsible for nearly half the number of cases in the state of California. So what is the debate happening over reopening here in Southern California?
Well, in Southern California, even here where, you know, you're talking about counties that are more populated, you've got a real range of approaches. In L.A. County, you had the head of the county's public health department, Barbara Ferrer, announced this week that the health officer orders would be extended for another 3 months. We're talking till the end of August here. And that took a lot of people by surprise. LA Mayor Eric Garcetti went on CNN the same night, and he seemed to be trying to walk a delicate line, saying on one hand, we still need to take precautions, but telling people, quote, don't freak out, and that some restrictions are going to be rolled back. Then you've got a real contrast in Orange County, where you've got communities like Huntington Beach, where we've seen protests over the last few weeks, people calling the coronavirus shutdown unconstitutional. Orange County does meet some of the benchmarks laid out by the governor for reopening more businesses, but it's falling short when it comes to the number of new coronavirus cases. And Orange, Riverside, San Diego, San Bernardino counties say they want to set up a coalition to tackle this issue, basically arguing they're more urban than counties up north, but not as big as L.A., and they're asking for a meeting with the governor to talk things over, to sort of set different benchmarks for themselves than, say, L.A. County, San Francisco, where you've had this incredibly high number of cases.
Right. And where most of the state's population resides.
Exactly.
In these big cities, in these metropolitan areas. And so here in L.A., we've got this, it seems like every day there are new guidelines, so it can be pretty confusing for people. what is open now and what are people supposed to be doing? They're supposed to be wearing masks all the time now, right? Outdoors?
Yes, and actually, this is a new change. You know, the city of L.A. has had this requirement in effect for a while that whenever you leave your home, you need to have your face covered. But now L.A. County, just as of yesterday, implemented that. And so that means basically whenever you're out and about, even ostensibly if you're working out, you're running, you're cycling, you're supposed to be covering your face. If you're at the beach, you're not in the water, you're supposed to have your face covered. And the message that we're still getting, even as the beaches open up, golf courses, that kind of thing, is that you still want to practice social distancing. You still want to avoid large gatherings, big groups of people. And you still want to avoid trips away from home that might be unnecessary.
Hmm. Marisa, what is it looking like up in San Francisco in the Bay Area? A similar situation?
Yeah, I mean, there's been slight differences. We've seen, you know, here they never fully shut down beaches. Of course, it's a really different culture here. The beaches are not quite as warm and inviting, so it's been easier to get people to distance there. We have seen, like, you know, the mayor in San Francisco, for example, shut down some big thoroughfares through parks and near the beach so people have space to social distance but still exercise. But I anticipate that we're going to be potentially in a shelter in place here in San Francisco longer than a lot of places. We are a very urban, you know, dense city. We've had sort of pockets, unfortunately, like much of the U.S., where folks who in our Black and Brown communities are disproportionately impacted. But we have seen a real expansion of testing options recently, both from state and local efforts. And I do think that, you know, as more people get tested, there's going to be movement in some areas. But I don't see anytime soon them saying, hey, go back and, you know, have a party with 100 people. Like, it's not, we're not there yet. Because as I mentioned before, nothing's materially changed in the, you know, sense of where we're at in terms of containing this virus and having the sort of, you know, tools to do it scientifically.
Yeah, and you see Santa Clara, for example, saying, no, we're not going to reopen. We don't have the numbers dropping. I don't know where you're getting this information, basically, but the Bay Area going a different route.
And I think, you know, one of the things that happened at the beginning here was a real sort of coming together of the counties. Seven counties, you know, announced the shelter in place here a few days before the statewide was one rolled out. I think we're seeing that coalition fray a little bit in the sense that different counties are going in different directions. And I have seen some concern from business leaders on that, because it's not as if everyone lives in one county and works there. And, you know, like, people have to travel between cities and counties. And so I think as much as there should be regional flexibility, we also need to think about, like, what message we're sending to people if they work in San Francisco but have to commute down to Silicon Valley. Like, how does that look? But I will say that the private sector has really, like, all the tech companies are basically saying work from home for the rest of the year.
All right. Marisa Lagos, KQED political correspondent, Howard Bloom of the Los Angeles Times, and KCRW's very own Cherry Glazer. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.